This is Gary Butterfield.
This is Cole Ross.
And you're listening to Watch Out for Fireballs. It is a Games Club podcast.
And this is the first live episode we've done in a while, you know, because of the world.
Yeah. There was a pandemic. There is a pandemic. And people got sick and we couldn't leave for a little while and we didn't do conventions. But then we started doing them again. And we did one and it was fun.
It was fun. Fun enough that we're going to do more. So
yeah, we reacquired a taste for it, baby. Mm-hmm. We're back on the circuit.
Yeah. We were lucky enough to have Bob Mackey of Retronauts guest on this. I believe we do a pretty good job of explaining in the episode what this is about. So there's no real need to kind of reiterate it. But you're going to be hearing us live. And it's probably going to be the best audio we've had from a live show. So if you're hesitant about this, we actually got a good recording from the board, baby.
Yeah. Also, I just want to throw this out. I think we alluded to this at some point. I'm not precluding revisiting this topic. Yeah. I thought this was fun and I could have talked about this for hours and I could have come up with another five examples.
Yes.
Like off the top of my head and, you know, way more examples. I think it's an interesting topic. Mm-hmm. Personally.
Same.
Yeah. So sit back and enjoy. Again, if we saw you at Midwest Gaming Classic, if you're in the live audience, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. We appreciate you. We'll be back to your regularly scheduled programming next week, and we'll have more live episodes this year, next year, as we start coming out of our shell, and we're doing just fine. A taste our mouth, because we got it all. So we are Watch Out for Fireballs, the DuckFeed.tv network. It is a book club for games. We do a whole bunch of shows. And here for the Midwest Gaming Classic 2023, we're going to be talking about 7 out of 10 games. What makes a 7 out of 10? What some of our favorites are? And ask you what some of your favorites are. And I am Gary Butterfield.
Hey, I'm Bob Mackey from the Retronauts podcast, also Talking Simpsons, a lot of other things. You might have seen my panel yesterday about fast food mascot games. Thanks for coming.
I'm Cole Ross, also here of this podcast. Watch out for fireballs. Sorry, this is very awkward.
Yeah, we're not used to passing mics.
Yeah. So our topic here is 7 out of 10 games, which is not us talking about 7 out of every 10 games that exist, but rather kind of talking about and trying to define what it means when something is like good enough to be interesting, but not good enough to be a completely
mandatory.
Yeah, to be like a mandatory game, or to be like a recommendation you could give without reservations, right?
It's worth getting this out of the way real quick. All of this stuff is obviously subjective. We're talking about games we like. We're gonna say something is a 7 out of 10, and you're gonna be like, "You fool! That's a great game. This is all stuff we like." But it is, you know, there's a weird space that criticism lives in that's between subjective and objective, and we're in there. So just play along with the premise. And also, if you don't think scoring games is good, you know, if you're a video game website from 2000 to 2012, and you just put out essay after essay about whether you're going to score games or not, let's leave that behind as well. Engage with the premise.
A 7 out of 10 could be misleading because that was the lowest score a website could give a game.
100%.
So we're using the entire scale.
Yes. A 1 out of 10 is like literally unplayable.
Yeah. And the American education system also taught us 7 is average, which is like, no, 5 should be average. Right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yep, yep. So what are some of the ways that something can be 7 out of 10?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we can get to that with our, you know, kind of with our examples, you know, but I think something gets to be like officially a 7 out of 10 by reviewers, and we can, you know, that's a different discussion for that. But also, like, I think there's a kind of a community consensus that's arrived at, you know, just you will see something like, I don't know, like to pick something more recent, and by recent I mean it was made 5 years ago, Vampyr. Like, mm-hmm. oh yeah, 7 out of 10 game. Like, it's almost like it was born 7 out of 10.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone thought so. And that was, for a lot of people, that was incredibly damning. And it's specifically a type of 7 out of 10 that I consider, which is that there are things about that game that are absolute dog shit, that are really, it's the Late Show, we can say whatever we want. The Pabst. That are really bad, but just really neat things that it does. So it's a case of high highs and then a lot of extremely disappointing mids.
Yeah, for me, I think a 7 out of 10 means you can feel you can see the human hands at work and you can feel the artifice. And there are 10 out of 10 games that I think are boring.
Like, oh, yeah, 100%.
The Last of Us is a 10 out of 10 in terms of technical quality, but it's the most boring, frictionless slide through a story tube that I couldn't finish playing.
Yeah,
so
really
that's my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Like a very professional, slick production that objectively there's quality there, but it's like, you know, how interesting is it? The other another kind of a 7 out of 10 that I think about are games that are just kind of average all the way across. Like, there's nothing really noteworthy about it. I don't know why somebody would choose it over something else. And that's a real damning place to be. I think that is a less interesting and worse game than something that might be worse but have another high. An example I think of for this, and this is, again, just my opinion, but I think of, like, a lot of the older handheld Zeldas. Like, the Minish Cap is, like, a 7 out of 10 where everything is fine. Nothing's great. It's kind of cute, but it's fine, you know. And that's though I forget about those games the second I put them down. They're done. It's hard to feel about them.
Yeah, you know, just kind of like give a little bit more, you know, more of a finer bead. Like 7 out of 10, you know, the thinking like, okay, we're defining that, but also, you know, like a 6 out of 10 would be like, okay, play this if you're a sicko for this particular kind of game, right? You know, an 8 out of 10 would be like, hey, play this, like, you know, when it's on sale. Like, maybe there might be some other stuff that, you know, kind of is ahead of this, but, you know, like, generally it's, you know, recommendable, right?
A 7 out of 10 is, let me have this.
Yes.
Like, you know, I'm not, like, you know, don't argue with me about this.
I'm not going to defend it. Like, it kind of doesn't make any sense to.
This is when you can actually say fans of the genre will like this. It's the one legal case.
Yes, yeah, that is a dead gaming criticism term, but you're allowed in this case. Another edge case, just real quick, and we're not going to talk about any of these, but something I thought about because of our recent shows, if something was incredibly technological or graphically impressive, that stuff ages like milk. The original Crysis, that's a 7 out of 10. It's a decent Far Cry alike, but now that it doesn't look like the most beautiful thing in the world, like why are you playing that? Yeah, you know, it's fine, you know. But maybe at the time it came out, it was very visually impressive.
Is there any particular kind of game that you think of as just kind of like, oh yeah, that's going to be in the 7 out of 10 corridor? I'm asking that because I have an answer, and my answer is survival horror games. Like, I love survival horror games. All three of my examples that I brought today could have been survival horror games that I would absolutely recommend if, you know, it's got that big
end. If you're a sicko.
Yeah, if you're a sicko.
Yeah.
But is there anything else that you just think kind of like really lends itself to this kind of mediocrity, but said with a smile? Mediocrity?
Yeah.
I think like any modern non-Mario 3D platformer, like A Hat in Time, those are all 7 out of 10s, I think.
Yeah, that's a great 7 out of 10. Like, it's not unfun. It goes down. It's not painful. It's not Death March. But it's also, like, I don't think about that game ever, you know? I know I played it. I have documented proof of it. But, yeah, if you put a gun to my head and said, what was the last boss, I couldn't tell you.
Some kind of hat, maybe?
Or someone wearing one. So we're going to, we each brought some examples, and we're going to talk about why these games are kind of mid, but also what's special about them. Just for us, we each have three examples, and then we're going to ask people in the audience, what do you guys think? Or a 7 out of 10, what's your platonic ideal? There are as many different answers for this as there are people. We put out a big thing on Twitter, or I put out a big thing on Twitter asking people what their definitive 7 out of 10, and I got a huge range of answers. It was really interesting to see.
Yeah.
And why don't you go first, Cole?
I was going to have Bob go first.
Let's
so
have
I could
Bob go
to
first.
The go to the right slide, since Bob is our guest.
Well, how about I'm going to let you control the order, since you got the slides.
Let's go with SimCopter first. Yeah. Now, imagine a game in which you can fully explore a 3D city you design, but also imagine that it's the year 1996 And 3D cards are just barely coming into being, and that is SimCopter. A game that's a lot of my games that I chose, like, the reach exceeded its grasp, or whatever that that expression is. And in this one, it is very, very ambitious. And there's a lot of very, very, like, GTA-style ambition. Back when, this is, like, before the first GTA game came out, and when that came out, it was, like, a 2D overhead game. But, yeah, I've always loved this one. It's extremely janky. It's the first, I think, appearance of Simlish in a Sims game. Like, when the people talk, it's in the Simlish babble. And unfortunately, it's very, very ugly. You can see about 10 feet in front of you at any time. And everything that is not a 3D object is just a blob of sprites. But I will also say this game is a 7 out of 10 as a game, but it's a 10 out of 10 for being progressive, because there was a disgruntled programmer who worked on this game. Who was gay, and probably still is, I'm guessing. And he made an intentional bug in the game that as you played more and more of it, the population would basically be taken over by shirtless men in Speedos who would start kissing one another.
Yes!
And now we would happily put a flag on the cover and say we support this and everything. But back then, Maxis was like, this is offensive, and we're going to patch this out. So I believe that person was fired, but He secretly snuck in something progressive in this very, very janky game. So there you go.
That's so funny. Like, gradually. Yeah, like, you're playing and you're just like, well, I don't like this. I'm from 1996. And then, like, more and more, you're just like, what's happening to me? Did I drink from a cursed fountain? You know?
But even if though this game is it's very janky, there's all this really ahead of its time stuff. Again, like, you can import any SimCity 2000 city. If you have the SimCity 2000 city maker, you can just make a level to fly around in. And this also has a radio station with different stations, with different ads, with different music. So it's like all of this early GTA stuff in what most people consider like a bad SimCity spinoff. So that's my definitely like one of my biggest 7 out of 10s.
Nice.
That story about that bug is so funny, because that is what has come to define SimCopter. Like, that is the top thing on the index card for that particular game. So that developer stopped it from fading into obscurity like Sim Earth, you know?
Yeah. They also, there's a similar bug in Sim Ant, but you couldn't tell. So
Gary, how about you? What game do you want to do?
What's the first one that pops up chronologically? EVO.
Yeah.
Let's talk about EVO. So this is a game I love. I absolutely adore. Nobody get mad. I love this game. Super Nintendo game. I read about this in magazines before it came out. I had this beautiful story where I kept going to the used game store in my hometown asking for it. My mom had bought it for me for Christmas and told Ed, the pervert who ran this store, he used to hit on her, told Ed not to tell me they had it so I wouldn't spoil it for myself. Got it, like, played through it in like a weekend, right? Cherished memories. And if you don't know the concept of EVO, it's an incredible concept. You are playing through different eras of time. You start as a fish. It's kind of like, what is Spore? Like a platformer version of Spore. You eat enemies and things to get EVO points, and you evolve your fins, you evolve your jaws, then you become a mammal. You know, you can become a human, and it's kind of secret. Like, a human is a kind of a cat-rabbit hybrid in this, to become a monkey, to become a human. All of that stuff, the coolest thing in the world. Beautiful soundtrack, everything. As a game, it feels undesigned. It is technically a platformer, but every enemy only runs right at you to kill you. They all have the exact same behavior. There are no iframes when you get hit. So, like, when a boss comes and hits you, you can get stunlocked to death instantly. And the only way to heal in battle is to evolve. So the way to win this game is to continually evolve and unevolve a fin as you fight to get your health back. It is the most artificial feeling thing. It does not emulate the feeling of emulation. It doesn't sell it at all. But it's such a cool idea, and it's so expressive to make your avatar that you're controlling a game with. I'd never seen anything like that. So it's a weird thing where it is not fun to play. Like, it doesn't feel good. It's just neat. And it's so neat. It's one of my favorite games, despite that.
I don't appreciate this anti-intellectual quote from Scary Larry. He's really putting down the nerds in the audience. But no, I like this game too. A lot of it is grinding, right?
You grind so much.
And then, like, it's just grinding for the sake of fighting a boss. And I feel like this does not support any theory of evolution. It's actually a creationist game because in this game, you are playing one creature who evolves several times within one lifetime, right?
Yeah, yes.
So you are the hand of God, right? Controlling this thing?
Presumably. Gaia does talk directly to you like it's Captain Planet.
And there were never any sequels to this, right? It feels like there should have been.
There's a prequel to it.
This is a
sequel, but there's nothing came out afterwards.
Wow, what a shame.
Yeah. But yeah, it's mid. If that sounds neat to you, play it, especially now with emulation. You know, it doesn't cost anything. You can probably find it for $700 somewhere out there. Play it for free on your computers. And check it out. But watch a long play. Like, watch a Let's Play, and you'll be good.
Yeah. For as grindy as it is, it's also very brief. Too.
Yes.
And I think that is something that can elevate something that might fall, you know, kind of, you know, out of being worth playing into, like, oh yeah, like, what are you going to lose? 5 hours?
If this came out today, it would be 20 hours long, and it would be a war crime. But as is, it's pretty good.
Yeah. For me, the first one I'm going to bring is a JRPG called Breath of Fire 3. Third entry in the Breath of Fire series, the first one to hit the PlayStation. I adore this game, despite the fact that it is an extremely bog standard RPG. There's very little kind of like twist to what is going on mechanically. Random battles, you experience up as you go. The only like mechanical change that you have is this master system where you kind of pledge each individual character to somebody out in the world, and as they level up, while pledged to them, they will gain special abilities and their stats will be shifted.
It did better in Europe than here.
What's
the
that?
Master system.
The master?
Yeah. Yeah, it was more of a European thing.
Yeah, and Brazil, weirdly.
Yeah.
Where this lives is something that I think is a pretty flimsy shelter for a game to live, but aesthetically, this has one of the best soundtracks that I've ever heard, but in a very unconventional way. If I was smart, I would have brought a way to play the audio for you, but it is this a kind of mixture of standard medieval fantasy music kind of thing with kind of a lounge jazz kind of feel.
Yeah, this was a patient zero for the jazz epidemic at Capcom, right?
Yep.
It spread to Marvel vs. Capcom 2, I think, and a few other games. But somebody on that sound team was way into this smooth jazz, and there was nothing else in games that sounded like it at the time.
Yeah. And something that I think that this falls into is it was outdated when it came out. Okay. Remember, early, you know, in 1997 in the PlayStation, everything was trying to rush to full 3D, or even the appearance of full 3D with rendered, you know, pre-rendered backgrounds. This, it had some 3D, you know, kind of elements like backgrounds kind of things, but everything lived in this beautiful sprite work. And going back and playing it makes you think of this alternate timeline where we just kind of focused on making incredibly beautiful sprite work instead of jumping too soon into 3D and having a bunch of Dorito monsters just vaguely insinuate at each other for just a little bit. It's hard to recommend this because it is, you know, a long game. But just from an overall mood and even a story standpoint, it spans an entire life. There's a time jump. You're like going beyond a forbidden ocean in a forbidden desert. You really feel like you're out on a limb, you know, kind of going to resolve this ancient conflict, you know, and the oppression that has resulted afterwards. I don't know. I've got a huge amount of affection for this game.
Yeah, I love these games that have, from this era, that are 3D backgrounds but 2D characters. There's something very charming to when the world rotates and then the characters suddenly snap to new 45-degree positions. I just find that so charming.
It looks like
that.
It would hurt.
Yes.
What's next, Bob?
So this is one of my favorite games, and I think the Metacritic is accurate. Because when this came out in 2010, it was a budget release, and it was being sold on, you know, so bad it's good. And it was sort of like, as The Room was catching on, this was a Room-style phenomenon, the movie The Room from 2003. This was sort of the same thing. Like, you play it to make fun of it. But, like, a lot of people like me ended up buying it and thinking, you know, this plays like absolute dog shit. This game has two enemies in it total, and the other enemy you fight like twice, and that's a blessing. But actually, there is so much care put into this game, it's astounding. And obviously, the creator has gone on to make things in the same style, but he has never captured the charming jank of this game. And I think what best sums it up is just how well observed all the characters are in the game. It's one of those games that has, like, the Shenmue idea. It has the Majora's Mask idea in that you can follow characters throughout their day. And in this case, you can watch them do very mundane things. Like, you can watch a mother come home from work and make dinner for her family and watch the entire thing unfold. And you're looking through their windows, by the way. You're peeping on them. And just those little moments are so great. And every time I replay the game, I will often see new things. Just because, like, I never thought to follow this character at a certain time. Like, oh, he just passed me on the road. This is impossible to drive this car, but I'm going to try to follow him home to see what he does when he gets home. And someone had to think about every hour of every day during different moments of their lives. And I feel like if it truly was a crappy game, that care wouldn't be there. And it never would have been made in the first place.
This is a game that wears its influence from Twin Peaks on its sleeve. In fact, the earliest versions that were shown, the trailer was so much like Twin Peaks that it, you know, who knows what they were responding to. It ultimately was changed to be like a little bit less of a straight shot. But something that, if you're a fan of that show, which I think most people are now, it's kind of like somebody said, let's make a Twin Peaks simulator. Understanding that the cool one of the cool things about that show was the cast of weirdos, and it's like, what if you could follow the log lady home?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
that sounded more sinister than I wanted it to.
This is one of the last times, like, what I loved about Japanese games before this era is they could just steal a movie idea wholesale. Just like, we're going to make our own Terminator, but also make it Blade Runner. And this is the last time they could do that, to the point where there was actionable threats, you know, to change the content. So I feel like I appreciate it for that, just for being a completely blatant Twin Peaks ripoff, but also funneling new ideas into that.
My favorite thing about this game, I'm a little cooler on this game than my friends here, but one thing so to kind of explain this if you're not familiar, you drive around in this game and it plays a legally actionable instrumental version of American Idiot by Green Day, which is so tonally off base from anything else that happens in the game. When you're driving, it's American Idiot time. Other than that, though, it's slow, weird, contemplative, you know, combat and him talking to himself about old movies. It's a really, really beautiful little touch.
Yeah. There's a quote on the screen here from the Destructoid review by James Stephanie Sterling that was kind of a famous review that a lot of people kind of balked at just because of the, how unfun this is to play. But I've really taken something forward from it, which is, like, if I'm to judge a game by how much fun I had with it, regardless of how that was derived, that kind of still needs to matter at least somewhat.
Absolutely.
Gary, which of your games do you want to do?
Freedom Force. I'll just do it in order.
Yeah, Freedom Force. Look at that Metacritic. This is aged bad. That's why this is on here. For people who only know BioShock, Irrational used to make other kinds of games. This is my introduction to Irrational. I am a huge comic book fan. So they did two games in the series, Freedom Force and Freedom Force versus the Third Reich. This is a game where, this is on the list to me, where the flavor of it is incredibly unique and so pronounced. These are very loving pastiches of very specifically like Stan Lee era 60s comics. If you imagine Stan Lee in your ear just saying, Excelsior, after everything that happens in this game, it works. The story is tons of campy fun. The character designs are pitch perfect for this. But it is a tactics game where you control at most four dudes. You know, you have on the flavor side, you have this big Biff Pow superhero action. And now we're really spoiled. You can play Spider-Man and you feel like Spider-Man. Like, you play Batman, you feel like Batman. Here you're watching tiny little guys slowly walk towards a tiny little gangster, who, and all the enemies just walk towards you and punch you and go, lights out, and stuff like that. It's horrendous. It's really hard. Your characters are fragile as hell. If you get hurt, you have to go searching alleys for healing things. So imagine Spider-Man's fighting the Green Goblin, and the Green Goblin punches him, and before you can do anything else, you have to go to another section of the city to scrounge around some garbage, which is what they did with BioShock Infinite as well, which is, it's kind of Irrational's trick. by which I mean they're bad game design. But it's I can't be mad at it because it's the most what Bob said with like you can see the fingerprints. It's such a labor of love. It's really really well observed for the genre it's pastiching.
This is definitely a 7 out of 10 for me because it's an I respect the core idea. I have no nostalgia for Silver Age comics, but I just love the gameplay mechanics. But I really tap out at level 3 because it is so difficult. I don't even know if they made the sequel any better in that respect, but this is a rough game to play.
It's so hard. I have put so me and Cole, we started doing our own picks for Watch Out for Fireballs. A million times I've been like, oh man, I'm going to make Cole play Freedom Force. And then I'll boot up Freedom Force and I'm like, I love him too much for that. Like, I don't want to end the show. I don't want it to be another Freedom Force-based podcast dissolution. Because it's so hard and it just gets harder in really unfair ways that are incredibly disempowering. And what you, the only successful thing, similar to EVO, where the recipe for success is do this artificial thing of evolving and de-evolving a Finn. To win at Freedom Force, you run away from a guy, throw something at him, run away from a guy, throw something at him. Like, you have to cheese almost every character to succeed. And it just feels wrong.
That sounds miserable.
Well, look out, buddy. As long as you stay sweet, we won't do Freedom Force.
Something that was fun, going through and reviewing this, is just how much like extremely campy anti-communism is in this.
Oh yeah, Nuclear Winter is the first guy, and there's a soundtrack with vocals where it's like Nuclear Winter, like to kind of march to the Volga Boatmen. It's really good.
Oh, that's great. Anything else about Freedom Force?
No. There's a really cool tie-in comic. That is done by the same guy who did Godland, with Jack Kirby pastiche, and they look great.
Nice. I've got mine, and this is not going to be a surprise. Silent Hill 4: The Room. I have this one kind of categorized under like an early misstep in a beloved series. Like, they weren't going to keep up the great streak forever. A quality dip had to happen. And people thought this was as bad as it was going to get. And if I could go back in time, I'd tell them, just you wait and see, buddies.
I have such sights to show you.
This is a profoundly strange game insofar as it did not begin as a Silent Hill game at all. It was a concept called The Room that they were attempting to make that late in production was kind of welded back into the Silent Hill continuity and world. And it was so called The Room because it added these sections in among the normal, third person survival horror kind of action where you were exploring this apartment where your character was locked in. And it would change over the course of the game. And this is one of the most effective horror ideas that I can think of. Initially, when you're there, your health slowly crawls up and fills when you're home, but as it gets more and more corrupted, that stops happening, and you can stop relying on it as your safe harbor as specific hauntings come in and actually start causing damage to you. Just a tremendously inventive idea. Additionally, this is a Silent Hill game that does not send somebody to their own personal hell. You know, you are put into a realm, but it is somebody else's. You are a bystander in this, which is very funny because every single thing that has taken the cues from the Silent Hill series has made it so you are fighting representations of your own traumas and repressions. And to see them just like veer from that in a very cool way is very laudatory. The thing that makes me, I think, subtract the most points from this is the fact that you repeat the game halfway through. You go through every level again. It is very slightly different, and you are escorting somebody. Like, the first half of this is wonderful, amazing, and then you have to do it again. And that's the thing that has stopped me from bringing it for the show, even though it is a game that I love dearly. That is an indefensible misstep. I cannot defend it.
Yeah, number one, I don't appreciate the slam on Dodos. Their only sin was being too docile, so I won't tolerate that. But yeah, it was the game sort of anticipated what first-person horror would be in the late aughts and onward, like with games like Amnesia. But then, like you said, Cole, they made it into a Silent Hill game because they had to. So you have a weird mix of like atmospheric first-person exploratory horror, and then third-person action with an emphasis on combos.
Yeah.
And I know a Let's Player, Voidburger, who does some stuff for Retronauts, and she has done like long annotated playthroughs of Silent Hill 1, 2, and 3. But inside of Silent Hill 4, she keeps a post-it note saying, don't do it. Because she knows what she'll be in for. Other people have done it. I it's one of those games I can only experience through playthroughs because it just seems like such a strange compromise that isn't a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's kind of neither fish nor fowl. And now I understand why she, doesn't do it. But the fact that that is officially in there, why Voidburger hasn't done it yet.
Okay, I have nothing to add. Okay. I haven't played this. I wouldn't play it with your hands, man. I don't have any interest in doing it twice. I'll watch you play it. Hexcrank.
Yeah,
Twitch.tv/Hexcrank.
/DuckFeedTV. Hexcrank is but one show
Our
streaming offering. Come on.
Well, fine. You keep that up, you're going to get Freedom Forced.
Oh, no. I don't like this leverage.
What do you have for your third pick, Bob?
I have Mega Man Legends as my third pick. So I think this game is beloved now. But when it came out in the late 90s, I think every critic was just trained to hate every game that made the jump to 3D, like because it was all bad news. Things like Contra, what are other examples? I'm just thinking like Contra.
Castlevania,
yeah. Like none of Bubsy, yes. It was all bad. And weirdly enough, I remember in reading this coverage, a lot of reviewers are caught up on the fact that Mega Man does not have a helmet. But if you play for like 20 minutes, you can buy the helmet. They were just so caught up in that. I think they just wanted like, no, I want the bosses with the weaknesses, and I want the different powers and everything. They wanted a classic Mega Man game. But this game came out before Ocarina of Time. It's essentially an Ocarina of Time style adventure game with the limitations of the PlayStation. And I'll say the biggest drawback for this in a lot of 3D games before the DualShock is that you're controlling a character in the 3D space, but you just have a D-pad. And there are many control options to figure that out, but none of them actually feel good. With the next game, you had the analog stick, but I don't like that game as much as this one because it's like a giant interconnected world. It was ripping off Miyazaki movies before everything did, and that was still a cool touch to give this Mega Man a new series some atmosphere that it didn't have before. And lovable characters, really cool cutscenes with, like, honestly, groundbreaking facial animation technology, just, like, using textures to animate a face instead of, like, awkwardly moving polygons around to simulate a mouth. It's just, there's so much charm in this, but it is a rough game, and I've never finished it because the final boss is too hard because the controls are very, very bad.
It's one of those things, too, where another way a game can kind of fall short is if it's in a series and it does nothing the series did before. Mm-hmm. Like, the response where they're like, why doesn't he have a helmet? That's silly. That's piddly. But Mega Man, up until this point, did have a series of kind of signifiers that made it Mega Man. My feeling with Mega Man Legends is it doesn't have very much Mega Man about it. Like, this could just be, like, a Robot Boy or an Astro Boy game or, like, almost anything. Yeah. You know, it is very charming, but it does have those awkward controls, and people had an expectation because Mega Man controls good. Mega Man feels good. Mega Man Legends doesn't feel very good. So I kind of am sympathetic to the idea of having an expectation based on a trail of breadcrumbs that began with Mega and ended with Man.
I think it was really tragic because the second game launched the day of the PlayStation 2. So you're setting yourself up for failure. But I will say, if you're upset he didn't get his helmet, the thing that saves your progress in the game is a robot monkey that dances the monkey. So that should win you over. That should melt anyone's heart, I think.
Yeah. My biggest problem with this is the combat, which just revolves around your enemies. You have to you're just running in circles, doing a side strafe, and doing like a homing shot. It is really monotonous.
Yeah, I compared it to Ocarina of Time, but the simple Z targeting, which is like in every game now, that was the game breaker, game changer for Ocarina of Time. That's not present in this, really.
No, but like, I defy you to find a fully 3D game from 1998 that looks better than this one does, just because of the art direction.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. Gary, how about you?
My final pick here is Call of Cthulhu, Dark Corners of the Earth, a survival horror title, not from Cole, but from me. And one of the reasons why I picked this was because it's another way that I think something can be a 7 out of 10, which is to drop off. This game has a flawless, to me, atmosphere. For the first maybe third of it, it is the best adaptation of a lot of Lovecraftian and cosmic horror ideas. you are doing incredibly creepy investigative work in an alien and hostile town. There are tons of little details. And it feels like they ran out of energy or money or something, because eventually it turns into a shooter. And once it turns into a shooter, it's not a good shooter. So there's a first third of this game that I think is pretty close to perfect. And then the rest of it, that's like a 5 out of 10. You know, and that's most of the game. There's still a couple good blips in the back half, but it's sometimes something can be, you know, the sum of its parts can be a 7 out of 10 because it is literally kind of motion.
Yeah, anybody playing this nowadays, I would say stop at the car escape from Innsmouth. Because that is where they stop adhering to the short story at all, which isn't a problem for authenticity or whatever. But the thing is, when you've got video game creators making the rest of the story, what they say is, well, what if the FBI, led by J. Edgar Hoover, brought a bunch of Tommy guns to
that,
a
that
gold
actually
refinery?
Rules. I think that it would just need to be fun to play. I like J. Edgar Hoover being like, all right, let's do this. But the escape, the Innsmouth Hotel escape, is, to my mind, my all-time favorite survival horror sequence. It is the most scared I have been. It's tense, it's perfectly tuned, it's very difficult, but you have the feeling of just barely making it. Just barely making it, I think, is the perfect level of making it. You want to nearly fail, and that is where thrill lives in video games.
I feel like, is this true that all Lovecraft games are 7 out of 10s, except when something like Bloodborne files off the serial numbers?
A bunch of them are 6 out of 10s.
Okay, so this could be the peak.
Yeah, this is, other than Bloodborne, this is probably the best one.
Yeah. Without a doubt. My final one is a DS game called Hotel Dusk Room 215. This is a game by Sing. They were primarily a developer back in the DS days, making games that kind of that made use of the DS's gimmicks. So like their previous game was really famous for one of the puzzles, you had to close the DS in order to solve
Ooh.
It, right? You had to blow into the DS. This relies less heavily on that kind of stuff. It is still present. But you do play this reading it like a book. You hold your DS, you know, vertically like this, which is a very good form factor for what ends up happening here, which is a mystery story that takes place in a hotel in 1979. You're playing a jaded detective. Everybody is kind of drawn in the style of the Aha Take On Me music video, set against very charming, chunky 3D backgrounds. And you are solving, at best, like Cracker Barrel level puzzles on occasion. And this is one of the ways that I identify that a game can be 7 out of 10, which is it's mid the entire way through. But there is really cool stuff in there if you are willing to put in the time, which is an ask that nobody can make of you but you, I think. You know, when you look at downsides, it does move very slowly. It is an incredibly talky game. You are here for a comic book, not for, you know, something that's going to be, super snappy, get
kinetic.
In, get out. Yeah, yeah. This is one of the only games that I've played that has failure conditions for conversations. If you just pick the wrong thing, game over, bud. You're kicked out of the hotel forever.
Fallout 2 is clearing its throat right now
yeah.
at you.
Yeah. Something that I really love about this and is kind of the joy of playing this is it's kind of not the original, but for me, it is one of my original games that I identified as cozy. The idea of being in this hotel, I think it's like around Christmas time, in this kind of filing cabinet for humans, surrounded by all of these misfits, all of which may or may not be suspects in this crime you're trying to solve, is a really cool concept and a great way to give you a bunch of different kinds of stories as you chase down leads in this case.
Yeah, the games from this developer in this series in particular, I think I would call them compellingly dull. They're very mundane, but in a way you're fascinated by it, like how they're capturing this mundanity of this world. And like you said, Cole, it's a lot of conversations, and then every hour you're like a play school busy box is shoved in front of you, and you put the red square in the square hole, and then you move on to the next part. But there is another game in this series. The sequel never came to America.
Yeah,
it's It's all in English, yeah, yeah. And I played through it, and it's just as compellingly dull. It's just as claustrophobic. You're in one building, and the puzzles are just as, let's say, lame. But the conversations and the characters are great. But at one point in the sequel, you have to find the single penny that exists in the game's universe. Nobody else has change. And it's really sad because this developer, they went out of business, but then some people got together to make a sequel to these games for 3DS. And if you play any part of that, it feels like a pitch to a publisher, like, this is what our game could be, but then you're being charged $8 for a 30-minute demo, essentially, for that game.
Yeah, I haven't played this, but I wanted to hone in on something that Cole said and something that's come up a couple times during these talks, which he said it was cozy. Another word we've used is charming. And I think of those words as non-transferable. Like, they are adjectives you can use to describe a video game, but you can't sell somebody something that's charming. Charming is incredibly subjective. If somebody says that the strength of this game is this is charming, that could be annoying to anyone else or nothing to anyone else. It's a really, really difficult adjective to use in critical communication. It's a weird, it occupies a space of being real and not real at the same time. And I think a lot of 7 out of 10 stuff lives and dies on charming or cozy, these things that you just can't pass to another person.
Yeah, you're Mr. Mosquito, right?
I was curious, Cole, like, is this one of those touch generation games?
Yes.
Because there'd be like weird celebrity tie-ins in which the Beyonce was in the Rhythm Heaven Gold commercial. I wonder what celebrity was playing Hotel Dusk. Was it like Richard Dreyfuss snuggled up on a couch?
I've got no idea. I didn't do that research.
Yeah, yeah. I just had this memory float up in my head. Like, oh, yeah, they were trying to get this out to more people. But it was like essentially approaching casual people. Like, it's mostly a reading game.
It was Beyonce for this as well. And it was really strange. Like, Beyonce was not as big as she is now. So,
yeah, I've got no idea. But it was very bizarre how they tried to bunch all these games that had very little to do with each other other than they just were not your typical style of game.
So that's all we got for this, but hopefully we explained. Boy, my voice cracked right there. It's been a long weekend. That's all we've got, but hopefully we've kind of sold the concept of it. And if anybody wants to come up here, we have a wireless mic and talk about, just briefly, because we don't have tons of time, but like, what's your 7 out of 10 game? Why is it not great? Why is it great? Both. Anybody want to come up? It's okay if not, too. We just figured we'd offer it up.
Yeah, and if you want to just shout the title of a game.
And we'll repeat them as well if you just want to shout the title of a game. Someone earlier said 50 Cent Blood in the Sand. I think that is a perfect 7 out of 10. Like, you're following 50 Cent to get his jewel-encrusted skull back, and he will murder any number of people to get it. And I laugh so hard at that game, and it's a real mediocre third-person shooter. It's so funny.
It's a real mediocre third-person shooter that also has, like, some of the design sensibilities of, like, an early 2000s Sega arcade game.
Yes.
Because every single thing you can do has a name and a point value kind of associated with it. So it's like
so
a shooter.
So when 50 Cent, the real-life person, kills a person in order to get his jewel-encrusted skull back, that has been quantized into a certain number of points. That is the kind of thing that philosophers would argue about, like how many angels can fit on the head of a pin.
I have an honorable mention, if I can name one.
Yeah.
Honorable mention for me would be Sim Golf. Has anyone heard of Sim Golf?
I love Sim Golf so much.
Sid Meier, who made the Civilization series, for some reason was allowed to make a game in which you design golf courses and you also had to play on them, but you never got a closer view of the golf course than the bird's eye view. So you're playing with like a little 3-pixel tall golfer. And so you were playing, it was just such a cool idea, but it was like, you eventually hit a wall in like terms of what you could do, but it was like such a cool little sandbox to play in, but like a perfect like 7 out of 10 sim game.
Yeah, and it was very much like a very competent management sim as well. That's primarily what it was. More so even than a golf course designer. I love that game so much, and if I could find a way to have us play it for the show, I would.
It's so laser targeted at stepdads. Like, who are
Stop
you?
Stop saying that about things I like.
Hey, have you always wanted to design a golf course? Wait, really? Like, that should be what it says on the back of the box.
It's what you play on the weekend you don't have the kids.
Yeah, exactly. And then, hey, sport, do you want to see what dad did last weekend? No? Okay. Mom been talking about me? Somebody also was walking by said Resident Evil 5. I think that's kind of a good answer. I like that a little bit better than that, and that's if I put aside any and all racial connotations. Like, if I put away my social justice brain, it's like that's about where it's at.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard that, but we are 15 minutes away from this bad boy closing.
Yeah.
Somebody else who came up to the table had mentioned the Assassin's Creed games.
Which, like, as a series, in total.
Like, as a series. And I think that this is a niche that, like, a lot of, like, AAA games can fall into, which is it's released and it gets big scores because it's, you know, it's a big game, right? It's Ubisoft. They
it's
made
new.
It. You give it. It's brand new, right? But the role that it falls into in a lot of people's lives is this is here to fill time, right? And we call these Ubisoft nightmare map games because it's just an anxiety attack of a to-do list every time you look at the map. However, they are worlds you can disappear into and just kind of go and do stuff that looks cool for a while. And I would like, I fell off of the Assassin's Creed series after like the 2 trilogy, the Ezio trilogy, but even like those later ones when you were doing like assassin management stuff, absolutely fell right into that. And so like, yeah, people might balk and say, Assassin's Creed, it's true art. Have you heard the music? But like, if you're honest about the, like the way that it fits into a lot of people's lives, like, yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of there to make
it's
an
comfort
hour
food.
Disappear.
It's, yeah. Yeah. It's a CSI or like, yeah, something like that. You know, it's Law and Order. I'm going to throw a thing out there, too, that's controversial, because Daddy's had one beer, and he's throwing things out there. The beat-em-up brawler genre absolutely lives in the 7 out of 10 realm. Like, Shadow of Mordor, also a pretty good answer. Like, I like that. So for me, I'm into it, but it's like a 7 out of 10. You know, anything where you're just kind of tapping through a bunch of dudes is pretty mid.
Yeah, the Simpsons arcade game is the best brawler, and it is a 7 out of 10.
And no better.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it literally, you just tap as fast as you can at the end of every level. Like, it is as simple as gameplay gets.
The so Shadow of Mordor and Shadow of War, I think, also falls in. I don't know exactly which one of these examples that we brought this would map to, but, like, a pretty mediocre game with one brilliant idea, which is that nemesis system and the ability to start having your own dudes infiltrate and take over these armies, right? So, like, moment to moment, it's Batman,
it's fine.
But, like, the way that that nemesis system just intrinsically gets you to set your own goals is one of the most elegant ways of making your own fun I've seen in games.
Well, it's also earlier when you said that a 7 out of 10 can't be too long. Right, yeah. Like Shadow of Mordor is like a 20-hour game. If it was a 35-hour game, like, fuck that. No. Anybody else have one? What do you got? The Life is Strange series. Interesting.
Life is Strange, yeah.
Yeah. So it depends on how much you care about the narrative, right? Like, when Cole was talking about Hotel Dusk, a lot of the puzzles in the game are real stupid. In the first one, they're like, hey, there's 6 beer bottles around here. Can you find them? And it's presented as if it's important. And that's dumb. But the actual narrative is, like, you have to kind of treat it almost like a short story. And it's going to live and die based on that short story.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good example. I love the Life is Strange games. I've played all of them. Just did True Colors a few months ago. I did finish it. Was there a bug? What? That didn't happen to me, fortunately. Yeah. I don't know how bugs are going to fit into this because all of that changes over time. Because
it's 10 minutes until we have to stop. We can't talk about that yet. Anybody else got? What do you got? Oh, sure.
Oh.
Like an old arcade compilation. Like, it's fun to poke around. Yeah, yeah. But you're not going to sit down and be like, I'm going to play to the end of Miss Pac-Man. Yeah.
Yeah. Once you get into Dig Dug's extended family, you're kind of done.
Yeah.
Like Baraduke and those games?
Yeah. A lot of those games are only made to play for a quarter. Like, we did an arcade special where I was like, I'm going to get good at Dig Dug. I'm going to put like $10 into Dig Dug, and I hated it. Like, after stage 5, it becomes a hateful nightmare.
Yeah, but like those collections specifically, God, I was a weird kid who loved those things on the PlayStation, like, in television classics or whatever it was. But like that experience of having, and this is before they were like really well curated, like Atari 50, right? But just having something to graze from, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe a little bit before there were like emulation packs or whatever.
And I only know this because of a friend of our show, Ray Barnhold, but in one of those museums, you can walk in on Pac-Man using the toilet. That's an Easter egg.
Well, 8 out of 10 now.
Yeah. Oh, Katamari Damacy, yeah.
Yeah.
The so I think I give them a lot of credit for inventing a new thing, you know, but it is once you actually get over the novelty of it and like the humor of it, which like they're very funny, they're very super funny games, what you're ultimately doing is pretty simple. There's not a lot of depth there, and you can see that by when they tried to go beyond We Love Katamari. Like, the first game has the main idea. The second game has every articulation they could think of, and then they put out, like, two more, and they're the same thing. There's nothing else in that well. It's a pretty shallow pool.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Katamari Damacy is a 10 out of 10. I mean, like, if I could give it more, I would, but them's the rules.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also soundtrack. It's all kinds of subjective things. Like, the soundtrack, it lives in my heart. Forever.
Yeah, but as a series, it's just a 10 out of 10 idea, no matter how good it is, might end up only so much tread on those tires.
Is it five games?
Yeah.
Got them. Parappa the Rappa. Bob, do you want to fight him?
No, I'll give you that because there are five levels. I'm Jeremy Lammy, 10 out of 10. I will have no argument against that.
Yeah, that kind of falls into the style, the style and kind of coziness thing too. Mm-hmm. Anybody else got one?
Nina. Danganronpa, that's Nina's opinion. I think
it's my opinion too.
It's a sterling 10 out of 10 for me. But my wife's in the audience, and I quote unquote made her play through the Danganronpa series, and she's a 7 out of 10. That's her stance. I won't say what she said. It's too vulgar to put on the air.
Wait, you're not gonna cop to V3 falling off a bit?
I liked how audacious V3 is, and that's all I'll say.
I don't know. You don't get much more audacious than 2. Hey, Gary, you can go home.
Yeah.
Visual novel chat.
Yeah. I can see that as well. I mean, anything that gets into the visual novel side of things, but like. I think that gets into it is so overstated, I think, in its aesthetic and with the stuff that it is kind of forcing you to, you know, to parse through. It's unpleasant in a lot of ways. Yeah, I could see that.
Who we got? Kyle. Sure. Oh, the Telltale Walking Dead Telltale. That's a pretty good answer. Like, I like those Sam and Max games, but they are, what those suffer from is an adventure game, conservation of detail. So there are so few objects that you just know the solution to puzzles because there's three things. There's three keys and one lock that's present, so you know it has to be one of those things. Like, they're fun games. The voice acting's beautiful. They're funny. But as games, they're not very good adventure games, I think, generally. I would agree with that.
Yeah. They also aimed at different audiences, with the different miniseries that they had going on. So Strong Bad's Cool Game for attractive people, aiming at younger audiences, as was Bone. But then they'd had, Back to the Future, Jurassic Park. I think that maybe that worked a little bit against their favor in terms of kind of developing a house style before they really found their success and figured, oh, yeah, we're just going to do Walking Dead again.
And then ran it into the absolute toilet, because then every one of them that came out basically after The Walking Dead is fine. Like, I like Fables, and then I played a lot longer than that, and I felt bad.
I will. I'll stand by the Tales of Monkey Island. I think it's very good, and I think the story is actually better than the Return to Monkey Island from last year.
Oh, fascinating!
Even though I like that game more, I think it did a better sequelization of what Guybrush had been up to, basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With the Front Lines Fuel of War, I'm saying it out loud so everybody can hear. Whoa. Yeah. If you think Tom Clancy's too intellectual, Fuel of War. Yeah, yeah. You can, especially back in the day, like, you could only have a game, like a good Akista's Ring or Arista's Ring. It was one of the only games I had on the NES, and it felt like that. Like, what are you going to do, not play a game?
Yeah.
It's not great.
You'll put up with mediocrity if you're locked in the room with it.
Yeah. And like it.
Like when it's the spring of 2001, you don't know what's going to happen in a few months, but you're playing Zone of the Enders, and it is a 3-hour long 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
But the MGS2 demo, that's a 10 out of 10.
Yeah. I hate Zone of the Enders so much.
I don't like it either.
I think we got one time for one more, and then we should call it. Jack. Vandal Hearts. I was actually going to say that with you. Yeah. The it's a tactics game without a job system or multiple abilities. You just have a class, and it just becomes a better version of it if you grind it up. That game drove me nuts, but I played the hell out of it because I'd never seen a tactics game before. Either of you guys played Vandal Hearts?
Yes.
7 out of 10 game-wise, 10 out of 10 if you want to see fountains of blood shooting out of everyone. It's a game full of hemophiliacs.
I didn't realize it was that gory. Huh.
Yeah, check it out. Like, take a look real quick. And we'll get the... Yeah. Drakengard 3 is the thing, which I have not played. I'm allergic to...
anything Yoko Taro.
Yeah, I'm allergic to Yoko Taro. I was diagnosed young. I played Nier, and it's a near-onset allergy to Yoko Taro.
Yeah. I've never played the Drakengard series. Is that the one that kind of led into with its alternate endings? Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, they eventually, let's outsource the jobbers of the video game industry to do our combat because we can't.
Smart idea.
Yeah. I think we're probably going to wrap up. Bob, who are you? Bob, where can people find you?
Oh, sure. I'm Bob Mackey. On Twitter is Bob Servo. And my podcasts are Retronauts and Talking Simpsons. Check those out wherever you listen to podcasts. And thanks to Gary and Cole for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thanks for doing it. I really appreciate you.
Thank you, Bob, for joining us. And thank you, everybody, for coming to attend.
And sticking around. It's not an attractive time slot, but I really appreciate everyone who strengthened it out.
Yeah.
Strengthened it out? It's been a weekend.
What is the
phrase I'm looking for?
Yeah, we're entirely done. Stuck it out.
There we go. That's not a verb.
But if you're not aware of us, if you are just kind of popping in, we podcast a podcast network called duckfeed.tv. Bunch of shows, just go to duckfeed.tv. You can also find the podcast wherever you listen to them.
Yeah, and if you want to support us, that's patreon.com/duckfeedtv. And thank you all very much. This has been a great weekend. Thanks.
Thank you.
Also, if you haven't seen this mug, come take a look at it. It's gross.
And yeah, that was the episode. We hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, we appreciate you.
Mm-hmm.
If you have thoughts about 7 out of 10 games, go ahead and send us a message at duckfeed.tv/contact mm-hmm. by June 15th. You can also send us, if you have reactions to Infernax, Pentiment, and the Resident Evil 4 remake.
Yeah. Or write in about those. If you have thoughts about multiple games, please separate them into multiple responses. You can also do the likewise for July's games. By July the 15th, you can write in at duckfeed.tv/contact. If you have thoughts about Burnout Paradise, Jack 2, or The Legend of Zelda Cadence of Hyrule.
Yes. The hot new Zelda game. If you have thoughts about those, that's July 15th. If you are a non-straight, non-white, non-cis, non-male creator, and you would like us to shout out a project that you have or other ongoing concern, please send me an email at gary@duckfeed.tv. Please include your pronouns, any pronunciation that would be helpful to my dumb mouth, and a little bit about your project, and we'll shout you out. Mm-hmm. We'd love to bring attention to lesser known creators as best we can.
Yeah.
Also, if you want to support us, you can go to patreon.com/duckfeedtv and give us some dollars. Another weird kind of sideways way you can support us, we've done some guest spots recently.
We have.
Mm-hmm. We were on a episode of Retronauts together.
Which was wild to be asked on to talk about Fallout New Vegas, a game that we love and a game that everybody loves.
And is not, we don't think of it as old, but it is.
Yeah.
Fallout New Vegas, one of the best games. I love to talk about good games.
Mm-hmm.
Super good. I was on a different Retronauts talking about the Worlds of Power series. We're also, you have been on the Elden Dogs podcast.
Yes.
I'm going on that soon.
Cool.
As well. So mm-hmm. look for us on other podcast appearances as well.
Yeah.
We get around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was also on a podcast run by our friend Doug Leaf, Nostalgium Arcanum, talking about Myst. So if you want to go back and hear a discussion about Myst as a series in general, check that out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Check it out. We appreciate it. Mm-hmm. We appreciate being asked and we appreciate getting the chance to do it. Also ratings, reviews, and Apple Podcasts, Podcast Addict, anywhere you find podcasts, and tell your friends.
Please do. Yeah. That's all the stuff. Big thanks to our producer, Gwen, who by the time you're hearing this is back from
big
her
to Bob.
Tour. Oh, yes. And big thanks to Bob for guesting on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully we'll have Bob back. Hopefully Bob will have us back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is a fun friendship.
Yeah. And until next time, take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.